Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, the spongy, soft universe of white bread. Also, cash for gold and discount foreclosures. The Law Booth offers cut-rate legal advice from a mall kiosk. But first, another sign of spring, the return of Occupy protesters. Chapters of the worldwide movement were evicted from many sites over the winter. Others morphed into Occupy the courts, Occupy our homes, and countless internet rifts. Those movements transcended the shanty towns that first gave rise to Occupy, along with the phrase the 99%, which joined the American vernacular and political conversation. Still, the movement, openly chided for being leaderless and disengaged from the political process, will not directly endorse candidates in 2012. Yet some House and Senate contenders are identifying with Occupy. Josh Harkinson is a staff writer for Mother Jones. He profiled the list of 2012 hopefuls who will appear on the ballot as Democrats, but maybe the closest thing we'll see to Occupy candidates. Josh, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be here, Virginia.
Well, just to be clear, are these actual Wall Street protesters with camping, you know, camping overnight in public parks, or are they politicians with Occupy sympathies?
There are more politicians with Occupy sympathies. I mean, there are a few candidates who actually slept in Zuccotti Park and other occupation encampment, but the candidates that I think have a real shot at winning aren't the people who, you know, spent time in tents wearing rain gear, but they are people who really identify with core aspects of Occupy's message, like income inequality or getting corporate money out of politics.
New York State Assemblyman Hakeem Jeffries is one of those embracing the rhetoric. Here he is at a rally. Now, this is held in support of Occupy protesters on October 25th of last year.
He showed a whole lot of compassion to folks like J.P. Morgan and Bank of America and Citibank when we bailed them out in excess of $700 billion. But we're here today to say we should show the same level of compassion that we showed on Wall Street to the people on Fulton Street, to the working families who are struggling, to the middle class folks, to the single mothers who are raising their children, to those who are in college who just want their piece of the American dream. What's the motivation? Take your pick, because we're going to take back America, and it starts today.
That's New York State Assemblyman Hakeem Jeffries there. Now, Josh, he is running for Congress against 15-term incumbent Ed Towns. Does he stand a chance?
He actually does, and it sort of hinges on this arcane debate over redistricting. There's an effort to redraw the 10th District to exclude areas that were part of Jeffries' Assembly District, where he's really popular. But I think the underlying issue here, and the reason why he really has a shot, is that there's a lot of discontent in the Democratic base with politicians who they feel have sold out to corporate interests. For example, with Towns, he supported the 2005 Central American Free Trade Agreement, which was really vehemently opposed by labor unions, and they're pretty powerful in his district. And so I think it's votes like that are making these incumbents vulnerable across the country, and the Occupy movement provides an opening for progressive candidates to say, hey, you know, let's stick to our principles and we can still win.
Another candidate in your rundown of so-called Occupy candidates, former Florida Congressman Alan Grayson. He lost a re-election bid back in 2010, but he's now campaigning again, this time kind of wielding this message of the 99%. Here he is speaking on Real Time with Bill Maher, arguing with humorist and conservative author P.J. O'Rourke.
One party is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wall Street, and the other party caters to them as well. That's the real truth of the matter, as you said before. And
get the man a bongo drum. They found their spokesman. Okay.
Well,
get a bongo drum, forget where to go to the bathroom, and it's yours.
Listen, if I am a spokesman for all the people who think that we should not have 24 million people in this country who can't find a full-time job, that we should not have 50 million people in this country who can't see a doctor when they're sick, and we shouldn't have 15 million families who owe more on their mortgage than the value of their home, okay, I'll be that spokesman.
All right, it does pretty well on Bill Maher's very progressive show, but will Florida Democrats be so enthusiastic?
Well, it's hard to say, and you know that's kind of the concern with these insurgent progressives who are capitalizing upon the Occupy energy. It's sort of analogous in some ways to what happened with the Tea Party in 2010, possibly, where you know you had these outsider candidates who were much more conservative than the Republican mainstream, and they won their primary elections. but then they lost in the general election, like Sharon Angle, for example. I don't know if you remember her.
Yes.
She ran against Harry Reid for Senate in Nevada, and she said some crazy things about, you know, Second Amendment remedies, you know, this sort of like veiled way of saying we're going to take out Harry Reid with a gun. And, you know, that appealed to a certain demographic. But, you know, I think Occupy is a little bit different in some respect because they aren't getting directly involved in electoral politics. But, yeah, Grayson is a very polarizing figure. And, you know, he can call Dick Cheney a blood-sucking vampire. And, you know, there are certain people who are going to love that and certain people who are going to feel alienated by that.
Yeah, so many fringe candidates, as you mentioned, probably on this first wave. But also on your list, Elizabeth Warren. She's running for Senate against Scott Brown in Massachusetts. Is she really an Occupy candidate, or is that just a moniker now being thrown at her by the GOP?
Well, I don't think she's ever called herself a quote-unquote Occupy candidate. And, you know, it's important to realize that, you know, people who consider themselves sort of stalwarts of the Occupy movement would never endorse a candidate. You know, I think that she really can very credibly say that she represents some of the very most core issues this movement cares about. I mean, she basically took credit for creating, quote, much of the intellectual foundation for Occupy Wall Street. And I don't think that's a stretch. I mean, she's this Harvard law professor who played a very pivotal role in helping to craft the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which, you know, exists to basically regulate Wall Street. And, you know, that's a big theme of the movement. And she's really sort of stood behind the protesters, even when Republicans have tried to use that against her by saying, oh, she supports lawbreaking and she supports these dirty hippies. But, you know, she basically shot back through a spokesperson saying that, you know, she, quote, understands why people are so angry.
We have to wrap here, Josh, but of all the candidates you mentioned, perhaps the one who most resembles the Occupy demographic anyway is the 25-year-old Elia Sherman of Illinois. Now, you're calling his primary race a bellwether progressives in 2012. Quickly, can you tell us why?
Well, he's running in this district that's currently controlled by a Republican, and it's not by any means a liberal district. And he's facing a pretty moderate centrist candidate in the Democratic primary who's actually supported Republicans, you know, given donations to them. And so it's a really stark contrast because he himself is a former mobilization director for MoveOn.org and, you know, has campaigned really hard on the Occupy message, you know, saying that, you know, the wealthiest 400 Americans control as much wealth in this country as the bottom 150 million and really like hitting on that theme. And so if he can win running on income inequality in a pretty moderate district, then it really kind of would indicate that a lot of other progressive outsider candidates can take the Occupy message and run with it this year.
Josh Harkinson, staff writer for Mother Jones. Now you can find a link to his list of so-called Occupy candidates at wordofmouthradio.org, where you can also watch those videos of Hakeem Jeffrey and Alan Grayson. Strolling through the mall can be an exercise in self-control. There are only so many shop windows and kiosks to make us think that we need something we don't plan on, like bejeweled cell phone cases or knockoff glasses. The law booth at the Boynton Beach Mall near West Palm Beach in Florida is one attorney's solution for providing something more practical, affordable legal services. Alice Hines is a business and retail reporter for the Huffington Post, where she wrote about the law booth. And she joins us now. Alice, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi.
Really surprised by this story. What is the story behind the law booth?
Well, the law booth was founded only a few months ago in November by an attorney in West Palm Beach named Melva Rosier. And basically what it is a booth inside a mall where you can go and talk to a lawyer as you're shopping, make an appointment right on the spot for pretty affordable prices.
So what kind of things does she advise you on and what kind of money does she charge?
She advises you on basically anything. The lawyers who started the booth first thought that it would be basically a lot of foreclosure clients,
right,
as their area has been pretty hard hit by foreclosure. But they were really surprised, actually, because they've been doing a lot of family law, people asking questions about divorces, starting small businesses, and it's really been a variety of things. So basically lots of different kinds of services. So you can walk in and get, I think it's 15 or 20 minutes of conversation with these lawyers. We basically just say, oh, I have this problem. I don't really know exactly what service I need. You don't have to make an appointment in advance. They're open on Saturday. You can go at 8:30 p.m. on a Saturday night and talk to someone for $25.
Well, given that scale and given that surrounding, it's hard not to think about this, you know, space being occupied by a kind of, you know, those cheesy lawyers that you see on billboards. The Saul Goodman character from Breaking Bad comes to mind. I mean, does Melva Rosier worry about her credibility as a lawyer practicing in the mall?
You know, I don't really think so, because Melva comes from an interesting background. She worked in legal aid for a while. So she, I think, is more interested in being accessible to people. So I think she wants to adapt the format of the legal office to something that really fits people's lives. Something that's interesting that she said to me is, you know, people want things immediately here and now in our society. They want things that are done the next day. And, you know, the legal and the medical professions haven't really adapted to fit that aspect of society. And I think she wants to bring the format into more something people can use in their daily lives. And I think one interesting anecdote that shows this is right when the Law Boost opened, it was near Black Friday. So the mall opened at 4 a.m. and the Law Boost opened also. So they were there at 4 a.m. I actually talked to her colleague, named Richard Carey, a young lawyer who, you know, was there early in the morning talking to shoppers on Black Friday. And I think, you know, he said, if people are shopping at 4 a.m., we're going to be there.
Alice, quickly, any sense that this might catch on for other lawyers?
Well, it's still very new, but Melva Rosier told me she had a law student from the New York area recently contact her and ask if she could franchise. So also maybe an interesting business model for entrepreneurial lawyers just getting out of school.
Location, location, location. Alice, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. Nice talking to you.
Likewise. Alice Hines reports on business and retail for the Huffington Post. Now, we do have a link to her article about the mall booth inside Florida's Boynton Beach Mall. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. So stick around for gay TV going for the straight eye to broaden the audience. That's what some of these once niche networks are being accused of doing. So we're going to be hearing about what some media watchers and gay purists think about the mainstreaming of gay TV. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a minute. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Speaking of a chafing dish, that must be my dear friend and neighbor, Mary Ellen McGillicuddy.
In the 1990s, Brinny Maxwell became a household name, at least in Manhattan, where the show dominated public access cable airwaves. The character was the alter ego of Ben Sander, a prototypical pre-feminist 1960s homemaker in drag. The show was emblematic of the gay counterculture media at the end of the 20th century. Later, 2003 brought a whole new brand of gay TV to the air.
All right, guys, we have Jeff Berman. He's a gay man trapped in a very straight world.
Well, wait a minute, Ted. What do you mean straight world?
Well, he's a gay guy who lives with four straight guys.
And look, yikes.
Look on your BlackBerry. I don't know which one is Jeff.
Okay, the one with the handlebar mustache definitely looks gay.
But I think that's just to throw us off.
Bravo's hit Queer Eye for the Straight Guy launched the trend of mainstreaming gay culture into pop culture. In 2005, Viacom launched Logo. That's a LGBT-focused channel that until recently featured gays and lesbians at the heart of its programming, with shows like RuPaul's Drag Race and the Big Gay Sketch Show. Logo's most recent programming, however, is different, a shift which Ad Age reporter Thomas Partey finds emblematic of a disappearing gay niche in media. He wrote about Logo's new lineup and the reaction to it for Ad Age, and we welcome Thomas Partey to Word of Mouth with more. Thomas, thanks for being here.
No problem. How are you?
I'm very well. So great. What is in the Logo Network's new lineup?
Well, it's interesting. You know, one of the big new ones is called Eden Woods World, which, you know, has one of those six-year-olds from the Toddlers and Tiaras show that everyone watches.
Right.
There's also a show called Scandalicious, which I think is going to be like one of those trashy countdown shows, like Best Week Ever. And then even, I kid you not, Design My Dog, which is like a reality competition show for dogs. I think there might be some risk in mistaking that for RuPaul's Drag Race. I think that's the joke going around right now.
Well, it sounds like any other cable network, right? I mean, how does Logo explain the reason behind these new shows? What's their goal?
Well, you know, I spoke with Lisa Sherman, who is Logo's general manager. And, you know, she told me that this is a completely reactionary decision, and it's based on what's relevant to the audience increasingly. You know, as the story goes, gay people are more accepted and more visible in mainstream media, and in increasingly complex ways, I would say. They're less interested in sort of an insular little cable TV world that belongs to them. And, you know, we know that Logo doesn't make decisions lightly. It focus groups everything it does. But, you know, they also have this study coming out next month that they've commissioned with, a media agency, and that's going to take a nice good look at their audience and what it wants to see and how viewers live their lives. And actually, interestingly, one of the early statistics from that study is that more than half of gay viewers don't actually consider a gay central character as a necessity to them anymore. Mm. I think that's really, really surprising and really telling.
Well, let's just listen to, you know, what's on mainstream TV. Portraying gay culture on TV has become pretty much normalized. Here's a clip from the top-rated ABC show Modern Family, which features a gay couple, Mitch and Cameron, as two central characters.
It was a supportive wah-wah. I was trying to save the moment.
There's no such thing as a supportive wah-wah. A wah-wah, by its very nature, is vicious and undercutting.
Well, I was just trying to salvage that story, okay? I told you not to tell it. You told it, and it died.
It did not die. It's a thinker.
And the only thing people were thinking was, thank God the story's over.
So, committed gay couple, center of a popular TV show, so out of the gay ghetto, is there still a need for targeted gay programming, Thomas Pardee?
Let me just say that I think Modern Family is doing a brilliant job. I think the dynamic of Mitch and Cam is so relatable, whether you're gay, in a gay or straight couple. And I know I myself find, you know, I can see myself, my relationship in Cam and Mitchell. But, you know, not all the shows are doing this. ABC also has a show called Happy Endings, and they have got a gay character named Max who is kind of the opposite. He's very straight and, you know, he's kind of a schlub. And, there's the occasional reference to his relationships, but it's all very heteronormative. And, you know, that doesn't sit right with me. And you know, maybe some gay people are like Max, but I think more of us would look at that and kind of see a network that's taking all the gay out of a gay character to try and make him relatable to the audience. So, I mean, I don't know that it does really signal a lack of a need for gay targeting.
Well, who would advocate for a need?
I think there's quite a growing segment out there of gay people who aren't really seeing themselves on mainstream TV. And they tend to be a little older, and they tend to be a little less kind of gentrified. And I hate to use that word in such a strange context, but they seem to be a little less aligning with the political movement or the political trends lately, which are all about, you know, we want to be the same. We want to be just like you. We want you to see us the same way. And I think those people might want content that's a little bit more tailored to them.
We're talking about the mainstreaming of gay culture on TV and other media, and whether that means there's no longer a place for programming targeted to LGBT, lesbian, gay, bi, transgendered audiences. Our guest is Thomas Pardee, who wrote about Logo TV Network and the inclusion of kind of straight shows in its new lineup. He wrote about this for Ad Age magazine. We have a link to that, including a trailer for Eden Woods World at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, let's talk a little bit about print. Now, this was one of the earliest forms, I guess, of a lot of gay media, publications like Out and The Advocate. I mean, you can really get plenty of gay news now in the New York Times or on the Huffington Post or on Gawker. Is there a need for these magazines?
Well, I think the money speaks for itself, you know, and according to the numbers for the past year, ad dollars in gay print are up. I think more than $300 million was spent on advertising in gay media in 2011. And a lot of that is in, like, sort of more local publications. Out and The Advocate are, I would say, they're struggling with the same problems that all print magazines are struggling with. But I don't think any of that is because they don't have an angle that's all their own. I think they absolutely do. And in fact, I spoke with Out's editor, Aaron Hicklin, and he talked a lot about kind of the gay prism and how some stories are just the best told when they're told specifically for gay people. And I think he's right. And I think as far as like the Huffington Post, they probably get the bulk of their content from reblogging gay media anyway.
Well, we're looking at gay culture disappearing as a kind of separatist culture in the media, you know, being more integrationist. How about in real life? How about in real life gay culture, which media is supposed to reflect?
I think it's kind of hard to quantify, but I think it has to do with age. And I think many of the millennial generation, we're familiar with them, you know, and they're kind of in their teens and 20s right about now. And they grew up during this gentrification period that I mentioned, you know, they're driving this trend. And it makes sense, you know, as we know, unlike Gen X, which was all about rebellion and kind of the counterculture, this is a generation that historically has always gotten what it wanted just by asking for it and just by playing by the rules. So this is the narrative, right? So it all kind of flushes really well. And as we know, this is also a generation that's a big target for marketers. They're the digital natives, and they're dictating the conversation, and, you know, they're determining how a lot of media money is spent right now.
All right, you've done a lot of writing about the millennials, the role that they're playing in these trends especially. But there seems to be this trend of gay millennials want to fit in while standing out. So I guess that's the whole question. You know, are we getting to the same place that other cultures have come to, integrationist versus separatist in some kind of way? Is that debate going on inside of gay culture in an active way?
I think so. I think gay people, it's not that they're afraid or that they don't want to be recognized for being gay. I think they just, they want to be seen as more than that. The conversation needs to be a little bit more multifaceted than just showing them a rainbow flag and expecting them to identify with that. You know, gay, I mean, even within the LGBT acronym, there's so much diversity, and it's, and you can't reach two letters at the same time with the same message practically. So I think there is a certain amount of that going on, yes.
Well, Thomas Pardee, I really want to thank you for opening up the issue for us, and thanks for joining us today.
Of course, my pleasure.
Thomas Pardee, reporter at Ad Age. You can find a link to his article as gay to mainstream for its own media at wordofmouthradio.org. You came into my life, and my world never looked so bright. Coming up, the surprisingly rich social history of white bread, that spongy, soft, frighteningly uniform American staple. You're listening to Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Word of mouth. Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
It's scientifically true. 8 slices of Wonder Bread contain as much iron as in 3 lamb chops. Sammy's mother sure likes Wonder Bread. It's so fresh. Always buy Wonder Bread. You'll be glad you did.
For most of the 20th century, Americans got between a quarter and a half of their daily calories from these uniform loaves of factory-baked white bread. It was the dough of democratic equality and of industrial progress, a superfood for a great society. A new book called White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf, traces the manufacture, marketing, and meaning of white bread in the American meal and mind. Aaron Barbro Strain teaches politics at Whitman University in Washington. In addition to the new book, an article chronicling Aaron's attempt to bake his own version of the 1950s-era loaf at home appears in Believer magazine. Aaron, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me on.
Well, America does have this kind of love-hate history with factory-baked white bread. It was this superfood that became kind of white trash food, or a symbol of progress that then became a symbol of decay. So I'm wondering what you discovered about these kind of dueling visions of white bread.
Yeah, I think the ultimate thing that I discovered is that 150 years of battling over bread is not just about taste or health or convenience. It's also really about much bigger questions of who we are as a nation, how we understand progress, how we relate to each other across our differences, much bigger kinds of questions.
Oh, well, let's go back to the history then. Why did Americans abandon these hearty, nutty loaves of the old world for the sealed-up rectangular loaves of sliced white bread?
Yeah, it's hard to get ourselves back into the mentality of that era, I think. Of course, it's a complicated, long story, but I think there's really two pieces of that. One speaks to anxieties of the early 20th century. We're talking about the 1900s, the 1910s, which is when Americans really started en masse to switch to bread from shining, distant factories instead of baking it at home or getting it from small local bakeries. And partially, there was a lot of anxiety in that moment about food purity. Is our food safe? And this is the most important food that people are eating on a daily basis. So there's a lot of anxiety about bread. And that gets mixed with racial anxieties about immigration at the early part of the 20th century. You've got all of these new immigrants coming into the country, and they're primarily the people who are baking bread in shops. So there's a lot of fears about contaminated bread. And the shining, modern, gleaming bakery factory becomes a way of resolving that anxiety. You know it's clean because it's untouched by human hands. That was the early slogan that the bakers used. And the second piece of it is that the loaves themselves were designed, were really engineered to look like pieces of modern art. They were streamlined and made sleek. They were kind of like the Zephyr train of food.
Mm. Let's look at a watershed project in the evolution of white bread in America you were talking about in the early part of the 20th century. Later on, the Rockford Project, which you called the Manhattan Project of Bread. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I call it the Manhattan Project of Bread with a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, but it's actually an appropriate label because a lot of the success of white bread, industrial white bread in the 1940s and 50s is tied up in war and the Cold War. But this project came about in the mid-50s. It was a multi-year, multi-experiment attempt to understand everything the government could about America's white bread habits and white bread tastes, with the goal of engineering the perfect loaf of white bread. It was kind of like Mad Men meets mad scientist.
And after a couple of years of study, what emerged? Fluffier and sweeter. That's what people seem to want.
That's right. The final result, after more, almost 100,000 slices and thousands of families testing different formulas, was about 43% fluffier than the standard bread of the day and 250% sweeter.
So this is the loaf that you tried to replicate in where you were then living, a town in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Mexico, of all places? How'd that happen?
Yeah, it's a long story. But I was living in Mexico trying to finish up the white bread book. And I got stuck on this idea. Is it possible? I had been writing so much about industrial bread, and I'm a kind of geeky amateur baker. And, you know, is it possible to recreate this? I was pretty skeptical. But it turned out that in my research, I had come across this set of instructions, or reference to this set of instructions that came out of this Rockford project that you mentioned, the Manhattan Project of Bread. And a great librarian at Whitman, where I teach, was able to track this down. And sure enough, it had very detailed instructions for how to produce the loaf of bread, which was called USDA White Pan Loaf Number 1.
Except for one missing ingredient that you were looking for.
Yeah, all of the ingredients were pretty standard household items, white flour, non-fat milk solids, salt, sugar, things like that. But the final recipe was a very small percentage of yeast food. And yeah, exactly. What's a yeast food? I knew that kind of yeast ate sugars. I vaguely had that scientific idea, but I did a little research, and it turns out that yeast foods is actually a class of enzymes and salt. And the name's a little bit of a misnomer. They don't really feed yeast so much as they allow yeast to create an environment where yeast can eat faster, longer, and more effectively. And it's all really aimed at achieving the cardinal goals of industrial baking, which is faster, higher, stronger loaves of bread.
I'm speaking with Aaron Bob Rostrain, the author of the new book, White Bread, and he's also read an article in Believer magazine called Atomic Bread Baking at Home, where he details trying to replicate this USDA number one loaf. Well, you find that there was a lot of energy spent on the process, of course, of making fermentation faster, and this idea of softness, which people seem to want psychologically, but not necessarily want to taste. This is where the strain comes. Factory white bread came to symbolize something much larger, right? It became a sort of barometer of which class you were from.
Absolutely. White bread, factory white bread, certainly in the very early part of the 20th century, was very much associated with class status and notions of responsibility. In the early 20th century, mothers in particular were getting lots of messages from experts, from the media, from medicine, from public health, that they had to make responsible choices about feeding their children. And if they didn't, they were a threat to the nation. They were a threat to their children and the nation. And one of those messages was, you have to pick the right bread.
And in the build-up to the war also, that it's a patriotic duty of every American to eat enriched white bread.
Right. So that happens because at the end of the Depression, as the war is building up on the horizon, U.S. government experts were terrified because at that point, a lot of critics had been gaining traction. Critics of white bread had been gaining traction, really pointing out its nutritional lacks. And there was a strong sense among consumers in the 30s that maybe white bread isn't so great after all. And war planners were really worried about this. There's this great set of exchanges where these war planner experts are talking about how, well, the Russians eat rye bread and the Germans eat dark bread, but look at the French. They eat fluffy white bread and they fold it. What's going to happen to us? And so to save the country, presumably, and make it ready to fight, they decide to synthetically enrich bread, add synthetic vitamins to bread, which is a fairly democratic way to get vitamins to every single American at almost every meal at a time when, because of the Depression, the country was living a nutritional nightmare.
I guess the French always suffer at wartime, don't they? But so let's wrap here. It's such a fascinating book, and of course the subtitle is A Social History. So what are we really talking about when we're talking about the ongoing ups and downs of white bread. I mean, we're told, oh, you shouldn't be eating this stuff. You have a terrific quote. Is it from Diana Vreeland, editor of Vogue, who says, you know, what does she say? I'm sorry.
She says, people who eat white bread have no dreams.
Exactly. So why does white bread, how does it come to symbolize so much about either a thwarted self or an ambitious American self?
Yeah, I think that a big part of it has to do with the efforts of well-meaning food reformers. In many ways, this is a book about bread, but it's also really a book about all the food gurus and diet experts and government officials and ordinary folks who thought that, you know, if they could just get Americans to choose the right bread or avoid the wrong bread, it would somehow save the nation. And I think what I learned in the end was that when food reformers focus so much on individual food choices as a way to change the world, two things end up happening. One is they tend to miss the root causes of what's really going on. What are the problems in our food system? And two, what you're referring to, even the most well-meaning reformers often end up reinforcing social divides between, you know, the supposedly virtuous us who makes the right decisions about food, and then the problematic, scary them that can't seem to make the right decisions about food.
Well, Aaron, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Aaron Bob Rostrain, professor of politics at Whitman College in Washington. He's also author of the new book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. He also wrote an article called Atomic Bread Baking at Home, which appears in Believer magazine, and we have links to both at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for a rundown that aspiring superheroes or superhero fans won't want to miss. Some real-life lab experiments that could someday, just maybe, get us a little closer to a real-life Justice League. You're listening to Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Sweet 16 competed this week, bringing college basketball's annual March Madness closer to the coveted Final Four showdown. Pro ball legends like Larry Bird and Magic Johnson built their careers in college basketball, and both were known for coming through at critical moments. Other players are not known for being able to deliver in the clutch, or as said of LeBron James, not being able to handle the heat. A wave of new academic research on last-second shots, free throws, and playing time recently hit the courts. And Tom Jacobs wrote about some of the surprising data for this month's Miller McCune magazine. Tom, good to talk with you.
Nice to be with you.
So let's start with this idea of players choking under pressure. What does the data say about what happens in that moment when a player's team is down by a point and needs that clutch shot?
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. You put your finger on the exact moment. That is when a game is very close, when a team is down by just 1 or 2 points, that's when the tendency for these players to choke is the highest. Not so much when a game is tied. That's probably the most interesting thing that I found in this study. But if a team is down by 1 or 2 points, these researchers, these are economists from Oregon State, and they looked at free throw data from a lot of seasons, like 2002 all the way through 2010, and they found that players shoot, on average, 5 to 10 percentage points worse than normal in that final seconds of these very, very close games. But that's a lot when you consider these are really elite athletes.
Tom, does playing in front of a home crowd matter? Does that change the averages?
Actually not. Interestingly, these numbers stayed the same whether it was home or away, even didn't change if it was a playoff game.
All right, so there's another body of research that looks at race and playing time in the NBA. What did the authors of this study find?
There's a study just published last year in which two researchers compared players of roughly equal skills, and they found that having the same race as the coach increased their playing time by about 45 to 55 seconds per game on average.
That's something.
That's a lot, isn't it? It kind of interestingly parallels a 2007 study that found that white referees called fouls at a greater rate against black players than against white players. I mean, again, these are kind of split-second decisions. We know it's in these sort of split-second gut decisions where, you know, you talk about the brain, where sort of older, evolutionarily older parts of our brain start to come into play. Mm-hmm. And that's where some of these rather unfortunate stereotypes lie. I'm sure neither the referees nor the coaches would ever consciously do something like this and probably would completely deny that it was happening.
Yeah.
But the numbers don't lie.
Another popular myth that's being challenged by new research is this urban phenomenon that the NBA is full of rags-to-riches stories about kids overcoming tough inner-city upbringings to become wealthy basketball stars. Is that accurate?
It is not, actually.
So that's all blown.
It's definitely overblown, let's put it that way. This was done in 2010, so again, it's a pretty new study of a couple of sociologists who looked at profiles of 155 NBA players, and this is over 10 years, and they found that a full two-thirds of black players and 93% of white players grew up in either middle-class households or upper-class households. If you want to look at it from the other way, only 34% of black NBA players came from a lower social class background. If you want to get technical, that means their family of origin was at or below 150% of the poverty line. So for the population as a whole, something like 45% of young black men fall into that category. So this idea that, yes, you come out of poverty, but you work hard and work your way up, that is seldom true. I won't say never. But the fact is, if you are born into a middle-class or upper-class household, no matter what your race is, that comes with certain advantages. You have better schools. You have better access to teachers and coaches and better playgrounds to play on and better gyms and better chance of getting mentors. So I think this myth of coming up from the worst part of the ghetto and making it, that is largely a myth.
Well, it's a surprising data from you today, Tom. I really want to thank you for sharing it with us.
My pleasure.
Tom Jacobs, a staff writer for with Miller McCune Magazine, which is changing its name to Pacific Standard next month. Find a link to his article and to our always clutch website, wordofmouthradio.org. Superheroes are again heavy on the summer blockbuster schedule. A reunion of Marvel Comics' The Avengers hits theaters in May, followed by the final installment of Christopher Nolan's Batman series and a reboot of the Spider-Man epic in July. The new film adaptations promise new gadgetry and CGI effects to stir moviegoers' fantasies and aspirations of superpowers. We recently stumbled upon a number of real-world inventions by serious scientists that could just as well have been designed by longtime comic book writer Stan Lee. Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby talked to some of the inspired minds behind a few of these superhero-esque inventions and is back to tell us what he found. Well, let's dig right into this, Taylor, with the Board of Imagination. What is it and how does it work?
The Board of Imagination is basically just a tricked-out skateboard, but it's been fixed with a Samsung tablet and an 800-watt electric motor. And actually, an earlier version, that one featured components from an Xbox Kinect that allowed the rider to control the speed and brakes with gesturing. But this new version of the board scraps motion controls in exchange for a neuro headset. Here's a clip of the board's creators explaining how it operates.
Piloting the board is pretty simple. What you do is you take the emotive headset, and once you've made sure that the contacts are moist, you simply put it on your head, adjust it right above your ears, and make sure all of the contacts are in the right position, and then it starts picking up the signals from your brain. So basically what I'm doing is imagining a point in the future, getting closer, and then stopping.
Okay, so the next one you've got could be a sort of superhero creature used by the intelligence or military.
Well, if I didn't know better, I would say that U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, is pretty well populated with comic book fans. According to an article in New Scientist by Anil Anathaswamy, they've unabashedly been trying to control insects for use in surveillance. And that's a concept that pops up in a number of comic books, including The Avengers, actually. This team at MIT has succeeded in doing this. They've attached a thin, flexible probe to the central nervous system of a tobacco hawk moth. And by stimulating certain parts of its nerve cord with these tiny little nanotech electrodes, they're able to steer the moth left and right.
Wow, how accurate.
I'm not exactly sure, but the level of current they use determines how hard the moth turns to the left or right. But frankly, they don't say anything about up or down, so it sounds like there's a way to go before you have to worry about bugs, on your bugs.
All right, so back to superhero inventions. Mm-hmm. We have the speech jammer.
This is my favorite. It's definitely our colleague Rebecca Lavoie's favorite. This is basically, it's a box with a handle, and attached to it is a directional microphone and directional speakers. And so the gun listens to whoever it's pointed at, so to speak, and then immediately broadcasts it back to the same person 0.2 seconds later, an effect which is similar to an echo on a phone line, immediately disorients and shuts the person up. So to say.
Should I be upset that both of my colleagues find this their favorite little tool?
It's pure coincidence.
What are the practical purposes for something like this?
Well, the Japanese inventors of the speech jammer say it could be used to maybe facilitate roundtable discussions or quiet people in a library, I guess. I also think it could prove useful maybe for marriage counselors, and I also think probably for authoritarian regimes.
Mm, and I bet conflict negotiations. But, you know, what are the drawbacks here? Is this a sort of free speech inhibitor?
Yeah, that's definitely a potential drawback, but I would say its effects at this point are still inconsistent. The jammer wouldn't prevent anybody from making incoherent sounds like grunts or groans, so it's not likely to have an effect on, say, a crowd of zombies or large drunken college students as they walk through a quiet residential neighborhood.
They are all really interesting so far, the superhero inventions you've come up with, Taylor, so good work on that. But a little, I don't know, kind of unnerving in some cases. Could they wind up in super villain hands?
Well, you know, the cyborg moth, definitely I picture it that way. But I will say the last invention I found is definitely in a whole other class. I spoke with one of the people involved in the project. His name was David Ershick, and he's a professor of biology and a functional morphologist at the University of Massachusetts. And he helped create a super powerful adhesive by imitating the foot of a gecko. But my first question was, what exactly makes a gecko's foot worth studying in the first place?
Turns out a big gecko, like a toki gecko, which you may see in a pet store, can produce around 20 newtons of force, which is about a bag of 20 apples. You got to remember that the toe pads on a gecko are tiny, half the size of a postage stamp. So if you think of 5 toes or 10 toes total holding up a bag of 20 apples or several pounds, that's a huge amount of force. And if you actually scale it up, what it basically means is that they can hold about well over 100 times their body weight.
The final product based off the mechanics of a gecko foot is a pad that the developers call Gekskin. And to get an idea of just how powerful it is, we have a picture on our website, and it shows a 100 square centimeter pad of Gekskin securing nearly 300 pounds of free weights on a flat glass wall.
Wow.
Here's David Ershick explaining exactly how they did it.
It synthesizes a very soft pad, which is analogous to gecko feet in the sense that geckos have these little hairs called setae, which are very soft. And then behind that, we actually get a synthetic tendon, and that tendon is very stiff.
How thick is the pad?
Very thin, like, you know, something like a sheet of a paper or something like that. I mean, we did that demonstration on the web where we hung a 42-inch screen TV on a glass plate, and it was pretty robust, so who knows? We'll see in the future.
Exactly.
The future. So, what, you know, who pays these guys to do this work?
Well, as you might have expected on that one, also DARPA was one of the project's funders. And in fact, just to speak with David, I had to get permission from DARPA. And during the interview, I jokingly asked him whether they were trying to develop a state-sponsored Spider-Man. And you could probably guess what he said.
That's classified information.
He said no comment, which tells me, yes, they are trying to build a state-sponsored Spider-Man. You've heard it here from
that's first. Real. That's real journalism for you.
But to be honest, of all these, this really is a practical invention, especially because the materials they used were so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I guess previous attempts to make an adhesive of this strength had to use nanotechnology again, which is very expensive. But one of the grad students who developed Gekskin, Mike Bartlett, was actually getting some of the materials he used from Joann Fabrics.
No way.
Where someday, I imagine, maybe you can buy some Gekskin of your own.
I'm going to call that a superheroic effort, Taylor, at getting some of the latest inventions that could turn mere mortals into superheroes.
Thanks, Virginia.
Taylor Quimby, producer and tireless aggregator of ideas stirring under the radar. For more on the superhero science he uncovered, including a gallery of photos, you can visit wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us today for Word of Mouth. If you did miss any of the program or would like to pass a segment along to a friend, please go to wordofmouthradio.org. There you can listen to past shows from our archives and post questions or feedback about what you've heard on the air. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott, and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson,
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella gives technical support,
and Dan Colgan. Dan the Man runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Really anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.